Welcome to Jaipur Bites. I'm your host, Laksh Datta.
This episode is a live session from day 4 of Jaipur Lit Fest 2023. And it's called Everything the Light Touches. Janice Parriott in conversation with Anish Gawande.
Hello everyone, and thank you very much for being here on a Sunday afternoon. I'm very excited to be in conversation with the fabulous Janice and on this incredible book, which I hope many of you have picked up and certainly some of you have also read before this session. I want to start off our session today, Janice, by just reading a little bit about the praise that this book has received, and it's high praise. Amitav Ghosh says it's a novel like none other. It's gotten praise that also compares it to a emotionally resonant as Kiran Desai's The Inheritance of Loss, as inspired as Anthony Doerr's Cloud Cuckoo Land, as inventive as Louisa Hall's Speak, and as visionary as David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas. So, you know, you've really got a stellar constellation to work within. And to me, it's been a novel that's wayward, it's delicate, it's tracing the quietly poetic language of the natural world. Tell us about how this novel came about, and what inspired you to write it?
You know, to a question like this, I never know where to begin, because I feel like all the books that we write take all our lives to write, that they somehow are part of a trajectory of all of the experiences that we've had, all the gardens we've visited, all the walks we've taken, the people that we've had conversations with, the people we've loved. And so it's very difficult, I think, to pick a particular temporal point to say, this is where the book begins in my head, in my life. But I suppose to make things a little easier and to respond in a way that's more meaningful to you, I think it would be in a garden, quite fittingly. And I love, by the way, that it feels like we're all in a garden right now. It's just the most lovely venue. In a garden, maybe a decade ago, somewhere outside London, I think it was Salisbury, I'm not sure. And there happened to be this tiny little exhibition in the corner somewhere of women botanists from the Victorian and Edwardian ages, and they stayed with me. They were wild and unruly, and they led lives that really they weren't meant to be living at that time. And somewhere a character formed, somewhere in my head, Evelyn, who we meet in Everything the Light Touches, and I could see her journeying from London to India sometime in the early 1900s. She was perhaps even journeying to a place closer to where I call home. And I asked myself, what is she looking for? She's a botanist. She's a woman. She's, you know, feisty and adventurous. And what is she looking for? And I think I had to write the book to find that out.
And that takes me to a very present sort of narrative within the book, which are these two contradictory urges, right? You have four narratives that stretch across the book. And at the same time, you have an urgency of travel. All your characters are traveling. They're going somewhere else. There's this feverish urge to move away, to discover, to explore. And then they're met with a quaint, quiet solitude, the language of plants. They're met with an atemporality that requires you not to rush in, as they all have, but to sit quietly. And what were these two sort of urges that form such an important rhythm within the book? And you're a poet, and this venue has always seen poetry at JLF before, so it's only fitting that we discuss it here. What is the rhythm that moved through the book And where were these urges coming in as you wrote?
I love that you place the central tussle within the book as a tussle of movement and stillness, because that's in some ways exactly what it is. At the heart of the book is a tussle between two ways of seeing. One that calls for fixity, for stillness, for calcification in some ways, for a knowing that perhaps is focused on categories and labels and boxes and names, taxonomy. And the other movement is one of fluidity and freedom and being unbound and having no tethers and being unanchored. And these two ways of seeing are what clash and meet within the book in all sorts of ways. Through the travelers, of course, which is why travel performs such an important vehicular function in the book. It behaves as a way for us, the readers, and for me to explore movement, quite literally. What does movement throw up? Movement, travel throws up newness, unfamiliarity. It throws up shifts in perspective, shifts in our inner landscapes, and movement and travel always, even though we're journeying outside, make us journey inside as well. It's throwing up unfamiliarity so that we may know how do we deal with this unfamiliarity? How do we deal with these shifts in perspective, right? So even within travel, there's this wonderful duality, right? And of course, within the stillness, within the fixity, comes a quietude, I think, that perhaps was magnified by the fact that I was writing this book in the middle of lockdown. And it's just become lockdown now, because I don't know how many there were by the end of it. There were so many. And I think I found that kind of stillness. I was very blessed and very privileged to have a space that could shelter me from the storm, so to speak. And within that space, there was this kind of quietude, perhaps that none of us had ever experienced before, a kind of stillness that we hadn't experienced before, a way of being that really suddenly centered us into ourselves and perhaps made us ask all of these questions about where we want to be and where we wish to anchor ourselves and who we wish to be with, and what do we really want to do with this one wild and precious life that we have. So these are, you're so right, the two impulses that move very, very strongly through the book, and they generate, I hope, all of this energy, all of these adventurous stories and situations that the travelers encounter, but I hope in some way that we do as well as readers.
You know, Janice, you talk about movement as a site of both rupture, but also as a site of this sort of meditation. You've moved a lot between Meghalaya and Delhi. The one part of your bio that has not been read out today is that you share a home with a cat of many names. Tell us about this cat and their many names.
Oh, my cat puts everything into perspective, because he doesn't care about anything. All of this, all the fuss and fury, the pandemic, literary prizes, literary sessions, literary festivals. Oh my God, all he wants is his little spot in the sun.
Where the light touches.
Where the light touches. And he's perfectly happy if he's allowed out of the door in the morning and he follows the sun through the day. And he does have many names, because as a cat, he is whimsical and willful and stubborn and will only respond to you if he feels like it. So he's called Vincent on most days, Pappu, to acknowledge his North Indian roots, but also Kitty, because he is just beautifully generic like that.
But you know, Janice, this is something that struck me. There's a certain whimsicality to the Cat of Many Names. The Cat of Many Names has occupied your bio for many, many years now. But this multiplicity of names is something that seeps into the writing. When I read this book, I was reminded of Agha Shahid Ali's poem, Kashmir, 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 right? And it's about this idea of varied names carrying multiple meanings and varied histories that sort of is such a central preoccupation of this book, right? The fixing of categories, the changing of names, the idea of something having a static identity. So tell us a little more about how that gets ruptured in this whimsicality of nomenclature.
Well, I think in some ways, Kitty or Vincent or Papu, whichever name he wishes to respond to today, teaches us a very important lesson that perhaps we can't really ever name anything, that the thing itself has to tell us what its name is, and that we have to be patient and quiet enough and listen carefully enough in order to be able to hear the name that is being shared with us. There's a wonderful book by Robin Kimmerer, who is this incredible scientist and a poet and also a member of a First Nations indigenous community in America. And she writes in this wonderful book called Gathering Moss, she writes, what do the moss wish to be called? What are their names? What do they wish to be acknowledged as? And I think, you know, as whimsical, as perhaps new agey as that might sound, I think it teaches us a really important lesson in how to be truly humble. Uh-huh. We are not here to own and name and say that this is mine. You know, we are here to say, what may I learn from being on this planet, from looking at a tree, from petting a cat, from being in a garden, from wandering around, having conversations? What may I learn? I think within that, there is a very important hierarchy that's completely dislodged, because we come from a tradition of science, of other disciplines that tend to impose upon the world a kind of order that we think, and possibly certain parts of the world, the Western Eurocentric world, think that we have a right to impose upon the world, right? We have a we are entitled to impose a natural order, including taxonomically, to name things, because we are in some way placed hierarchically above all of nature, that we are the darlings of creation, that we sit atop this fabricated entirely, this pyramid of who is important in this world. Right? And we sit right at the top of that. And so we name things and we give order. We bestow order upon the world. And I think it's a deeply sort of enlightenment-driven, impulse. But to say, let me stand back. Let me dismantle this pyramid. Let me listen. Let me ask a question and begin a dialogue with the world. Let me be in conversation. Let me see what I may learn. I think that's far more meaningful. That's far more perhaps helpful for us as a species as well to learn.
And I think this is important, right? And in the book, Evelyn's journey is running away from sexism in botany and within the sort of corridors of academia and of the sexism present within. And the political implications of this book, I think, become far more evident when she comes and realizes that the violence is not just in the ways in which academia perpetuates sexism, but in the very way in which the field exists, right? what is the violence of naming? What is the violence of creating fixed categories, right? And you know, I'd done a show recently where I showed Garima Gupta's work. She's a fabulous artist who creates these light boxes about minerals and the sort of invisible histories of the sort of minerals that exist in natural history museums across the Western world, which sort of hide the history of mining, that hide the letters written by people back home, by including by those who were sent there to mine from the West. And in many ways, I think the book asks us to think deeper about what does it mean to create these categories and set them in stone, and the violence that follows through it.
Absolutely. I think, you know, the reason why this... I know that there's a lot of lyricism and beauty and poeticism that people take great comfort from while reading this book, but it is quite honestly the most deeply political book that I've ever written. And it is precisely because of this, it is trying at its very heart to dismantle or to question categories. Everything in the world that we fight against, everything that we try and resist, is attempting to do just that, to put us into boxes. Nationalism, caste, gender, sexuality, class, they're trying to reduce us, to diminish us into this singular narrative, into this one thing. And this book is questioning that, the very foundations upon which all of these isms are built, you know? And so it's trying to disrupt at a very, very foundational level. And thank you so much for bringing that up and for picking up on that.
No, thank you so much, because I think we've had a lot of sessions this GLF. We had your wonderful session with Merlin and Fungi. We've sort of spoken about the natural world so profoundly. And I think there has been a sort of characterization of innocence that is really important to sort of bring out. But here you see the sort of insidious nature of that innocence, right? You see the violence that sort of traverses the same path that innocence travels upon. I want to shift gears very quickly because I'm also aware of the time. And I want to turn to the form of this book. The first time I read this book and the first time I met Janice at GLF this year, I said, you must be absolutely mad. She's crazy. She's written a book that nobody can edit. I saw her editor today and said, I pity you. Because it's prose poetry, lyricism, and fiction, and nonfiction, and history, everything, everywhere, all at once. What were you thinking, Janice? What are you doing?
I have no idea. But one must be mad, no?
Evidently.
One must be a little crazy and a little obsessed and a little sort of, oh my God, what am I doing? But I must do this anyway because there's something here. And there's something that this book is trying to do. And to be very honest, this is also one of my books that I feel was not quite written by me. It comes from elsewhere. It comes from the earth, it comes from the cosmic, it comes from my ancestors, it comes from everything everywhere all at once, and it feels like it has been told through me, but not by me. That it's such an epic work of collaboration. That's what it is.
Like your acknowledgement section, which runs on and on. So I want to take some time to also get Janice to read, because she reads so beautifully. The central section of this book is the chapter on Linnaeus, who is the only character to have only one chapter, but he gets the chapter at the center of the book because it's structured like a palindrome. So the four characters, each of them get two chapters, and in the middle of them sits Linnaeus. And Linnaeus's section is poetry, prose poetry, disrupting everything, everywhere, all at once, and concrete poetry. But the one poem I want you to read is this lovely one that really brings out everything that the light touches, and what the light touches that we don't know too much about. So, Janice.
I'd be delighted. So just a little context. All of these poems are written as part of a larger lyric narrative, a lyric travel narrative that's told by Linnaeus, our Swedish botanist who's very earnest and very serious about the job that he's doing. He's 25 years old and he's setting out on his first and probably last solo adventure. He wasn't quite the avid sort of traveler as the others are. Some of these poems, though, while Linnaeus is writing to the land, to the people, imposing all sorts of taxonomical order on what he sees, there are some poems, very few, but they're there, that speak back. And these are the indigenous peoples on that land. These are poems that the earth writes back to Linnaeus. And this is one of them. And it's called Brunnesberget. It's the place of it, it's the name of a place. For Linnaeus, as you approach Brunnesberget, turn left. Find a cave formed by nature in the mountain, resembling a dwelling made all out of stone. The front is open, narrower, lower than within, which is so lofty you cannot reach the roof. The entrance is concealed, guarded on the outside by two large trees, a fir and a birch, while the descent lies hard and steep. On the floor you find rocks, burnt stumps, and the neighboring people inform you that for 2 years a man, sage or criminal, concealed himself in this cavern. You linger a while for moss on stone, for fungus textured like sponge, and something else entirely undiscoverable. Everywhere near the road, glittering in the sun, lies spar full of talc or fine Muscovy glass. Stones are piled on stones. Are you outside or in? You cannot be certain. Not everything the light touches can be seen.
I'm going to let us just sit with that for a second, Janice, because, you know, that's, I think that's where the book really shines. I think it's in these moments of quiet reflection, of solitude, of, as you said, the poem speaking back, of this narrative sort of weaving in. And a lot of reviews have said, you know, we don't know how these things fit together. And I think this is where they fit together. This is where the sort of book speaks back in some ways and holds a quiet sort of tenuous link that moves around. I want to turn a little also to the fact that across the book, we hear of what the plants are teaching us. We hear of how to learn from plants. And I want you to, again, because we already started off reading, I want you to continue reading, and this time from a prose section. And if I can find it. There we go. On Moritz and Goethe.
I'd love to. This is Goethe in Rome in 1886. Sorry, was it 1786? Yes, time.
We'll get to that also in a bit, about the time.
Absolutely. I will have perfectly eloquent things to say by then about time. I just keep getting dates mixed up. But this is Goethe in Rome, in a place unlike any other that he's ever seen, and it's been his lifelong wish to be there for many reasons. But for many reasons, this journey is very important to the book. Goethe's flight to Italy, as he calls it, because it is a dream fulfilled. But it's important to the book because it's also the place where he witnesses a kind of lushness and greenness that he has never witnessed in his more, shall we say, northerly homeland, right? And he's here and he's having conversations with friends. And he's in a garden, much like we are, and they're talking. And this is what he says. Should I start from this bit?
I think from, yeah.
Okay. He's holding a bay leaf in his hand. Goethe points at it. How does this smell to you? Moritz sniffs it again. Oddly enough, of my mother's tomato sauce. To me, says Goethe, a stuffy university hall filled with graduates wearing laurel wreaths. He smiles, his eyes shining. We have rich facilities with which to absorb the world, the gift of our eyes and noses and ears, and yet, often we sacrifice all of these at the altar of our so-called intellectual mind. He taps his forehead. Then he steps closer to the laurel tree. The leaves press into his shoulders, his chest. I think one way to overcome object thinking is to approach a living thing as the subject that it is. This calls for careful looking and thinking with the mind's eye, Moritz. Onschwang, and then asking one and only one question of any importance, which is, what do you have to teach me? The laurel towers over his head, its leaves waving in the breeze. Do you see why, Moritz? His friend hesitates. Because this invites dialogue? Yes, says Goethe, pleased. A way by which we strive to stay close to what is being studied, to learn what the plant has to tell us, rather than to impose on it what we already believe. Moritz leans closer to the bush. How does one do this? In Goethe's voice, a tremor of excitement. If we wish to behold nature in a living way, we must follow her example and make ourselves as mobile and flexible as nature herself. With this, he detaches himself from the laurel and makes to walk away. Moritz follows. We must aspire, my friend, Goethe continues, to think like a plant. By this, he does not mean they need to learn how to purify air using the action of the sun. He laughs, pleased with his own joke. Rather, we learn from plants a way of living thinking. With my gentian, it struck me how, even in its apparent stillness, it was a dynamically sensitive being, forming and changing itself through dialogue with whatever conditions it met in the world. Air, moisture, light. They clatter down the monumental stairs and take the path that leads to the wooded slopes of Monte Mario. To be inspired by plants, Moritz, is to learn to drop fixed ideas, to enter into an open-ended dialogue with the world. Goethe gazes up at the canopy, raising his arms in a gesture of embrace. And maybe then, all will be revealed. Thank you.
Thank you so, so much again, Janice. And I feel very glad to be on stage with you today because I feel that I'm indulging myself in having you read out and doing myself a great favor by asking whatever I want to on this stage. I'm going to ask you one last question because I know we also have a lovely audience that's eager to ask you questions. You know, this book is part of an emerging set of narratives that are preoccupied with not just an attitude towards nature as one of wonder and awe. And yesterday, Ranjith Hoskote was speaking about ice light. And he spoke about what does it mean not only to talk of nature like the romantics, but rather to think through nature. And there's a beautiful essay by Nikita Azad in Aeon, which talks about moss and what does it mean to sort of touch and feel and think through moss. And your book, again, both through its political project and through the waywardness, as Saidiya Hartman would call it, manages to sort of traverse along an uncertain path, asks us, like your passage just described, to think through plants, not off plants. Do you think you're in a moment?
It certainly feels like it, even though everything is unplanned and everything is unmanipulated. It took me 10 years to work on this book, and it cannot in some ways be any kind of preemption, at least for me, that far in advance. But I do feel that because I was perhaps in a space where these conversations were just beginning to emerge. I was in London, I was studying. I was surrounded by friends who were at places like the Schumacher College in Totnes, which actually offer courses on Goethean science. So I think I was at a place with certain people where these conversations were just beginning to emerge. And this question, which I think reached a kind of crescendo during the pandemic, the question of what is our relationship to our planet, to our Earth, were just beginning to be murmured out into, you know, the public, out into spaces like these. And of course, there is also this incredible, inexplicable alignment, things that you can't explain. What is it about this moment? I think that actually it's not about this moment at all, because we often tend to think of the ecological crisis, climate change, as a thing, as an issue of here and now, but it isn't really. It began so long ago, so many centuries past, and I think perhaps to speak of being in a moment actually sends me looking back rather than just forward or just here. It makes me wonder, where can we actually travel to understand what this moment is? It's what I hope the book does as well, offer this long perspective, this sense that things are always in some kind of continuum, that there is continuity always, that Linnaeus's story is linked to Shai's story and to the anti-uranium movement, even though they seem to sit on literally separate parts of the planet and in separate temporal spaces, right? So this is a moment, but I think that it's also a very long moment, that it had always been there somehow, and we need to understand how we grasp and hold this moment, but also let it go into a future in a meaningful way. No?
I love the temporality of that and this idea of motion and this idea of the past meeting the present, fact bleeding into fiction, memory crossing the line into sort of imagination. And I want you to read one last bit, which is my final vignette from the book, from Evelyn's chapter, which I think, after I've met you, reminds me a little of you, on her grandmother. And after that, please keep your questions ready. We'll have 10 minutes for questions.
Is it a dream or a memory of walking through a forest with Grandma Grace? She was 9 and something caught her attention. A beetle, a colorful toadstool, and when she straightened up, she was alone. She wasn't immediately frightened. She was certain Grandma Grace would be ahead, tall, handsome, smiling, with her hat and scarf and basket, the sun behind her, lighting her up like a painting. Evie walked on, but Grandma Grace was gone. She stumbled forward, calling out, but the woods were silent around her, undisturbed except for the thud of her small footsteps and her heart. Soon it was a path no longer, but rough undergrowth, the trees growing taller and closer. She was crying, but not too loudly, in case someone other than her grandmother would hear her, wolves or bears or other monsters. When she started slowing down, exhausted, she suddenly came to a stream. And on the other side, standing as though she had always been waiting, was Grandma Grace. "Come," she called across the water, gesturing to her granddaughter. And Evie stood on a stone on the opposite bank and hesitated. "Don't be afraid, darling," she said, her arms open and waiting as Evie leaped across. But this is when she wakes. Or the memory ends. Does she make it? Does she not? She doesn't remember. She doesn't know.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Jaipur Bites. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. This podcast is produced by Lonchora in association with Teamwork Arts. Please follow or subscribe to this show wherever you're listening to this to be notified about new episodes.